Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two segments today. First, are we really all that sure Hillary is the lesser evil? Rania Kolik will muse on that. And then at the bottom of the hour, David Columbia will talk about the politics of Bitcoin. First, Rania Kolik. She is the associate editor of the Electronic Intifada and is a prolific writer on the Middle East in particular. Donald Trump is a revolting horror, no question about it. But is our fear of him blinding us to just how frightfully bellicose our probable next president is? Here's Rania Kolik to help us think that through. Hillary is the lesser evil. I guess, you know, that concedes that both candidates are pretty evil. Let's talk about foreign policy, which is what you write a lot about, the Middle East in particular. Is Hillary clearly the lesser evil in that kind of context?
It's hard to say, because here's the thing, is she's not the lesser evil, is how I'll put it. Because, you know, as Donald Trump has said, he wants to do awful things. He surrounded himself with, like, some of the most horrible neocons imaginable. Like, the really most far right-wing, like, unhinged people are his advisors. That said, like, it's Hillary Clinton who seems intent on starting a war with Russia, not Donald Trump. And especially in context to Syria. And I don't know if we want to go into that further, but it's just that's what's really scary about Hillary Clinton. It's like, everyone's kind of agreed that she does have a more belligerent streak in terms of, like, solving things through using military force, right? Donald Trump doesn't have a record, and he says sometimes reasonable things. But Hillary Clinton, I mean, she has surrounded herself with, and in her own rhetoric, seems to want to confront Russia. And we kind of also see this in the rhetoric of the Democratic Party in general. I don't know if that's just isolated to the campaign or if that's going to go away, but it's really alarming.
The willingness and eagerness, really, to confront Russia, to blame Russia for the leaks, to paint Putin as some sort of, I don't know, latter-day Stalin crossed with Hitler. It's just remarkable to watch this. It's like the Cold War without communists. I don't really understand what precisely is driving this passionate hatred of Russia. Do you have any sense of what it's all about?
Well, there's been, in the past several years now, an attempt, at least by, like, neocons in particular, to really shift from, or, you know, like, transition from the war on terror to, like, a war on Russia. You know, and China, actually. You just don't hear about that as much. But to make this, like, you know, more of a confrontation with Russia and to really, revitalize the Cold War. And yeah, it's bizarre, right? Because, like, it's not like there's an ideology here that you're trying to fight. So there's no communists or professed communists that we're fighting. It's, like, about, I guess, American hegemony, especially in the Middle East. But also there's just NATO is, like, obsessed. And NATO is the U.S. for the most part. And it's, like, obsessed with provoking Russia in many ways in what it's doing. But if you look at, like, the think pieces coming out from the think tanks the past several years, it is this, like, slowly, you know, shifting move from a focus on the Middle East and the war on terror to, like, a focus on Russia and China. And, you know, I don't know what that means. I don't know if that's because, you know, all the weapons industry, like, the weapons industry funds a bunch of the think tanks and they'll profit off of, you know, they need a new boogeyman. Because if you notice, Doug, it's like, I guess the war on terror isn't working as well to justify U.S. intervention abroad, not like the way it did before. And so it seems as though you need, like, a new boogeyman to, like, keep the defense industry profits coming. I don't know. There's a lot of factors at play here. But, I mean, either way, Hillary Clinton is the one who's going to take us to World War III.
We can laugh about that now, but when we're huddled in the shelters. Those two issues come together, the Middle East and Russia around Syria. And we heard Donald Trump the other night say, why not work with Russia to solve the problem of Syria? You know, we don't know what he really means by that. But on the face of it, working with Russia seems like not a bad idea. Yet, this is perceived as evidence of his deep evil. What about, you know, Syria? Syria is an immensely complicated thing. I have no idea what an American policy should be towards Syria, except maybe staying out of it. But, like, what are your thoughts on what's going on there?
You know, Syria, I have to say, it's one of the most distorted conflicts ever. And what I mean by that is just the Western media coverage of Syria. Like you said, it's like Russia is just the biggest evil in the whole world. And the Assad regime is basically just like Hitler and the Nazis. And there's just like a one-sided slaughter happening in Syria. That doesn't mean, that's not to say that like what Russia's doing in Syria is okay or what the Syrian government does is okay. They're certainly committing crimes. But the fact that there's just this obsessive focus on what Russia's doing when the U.S. is doing the same exact stuff that Russia's doing, but it's doing it to ISIS-held areas in both Syria and Iraq. It's surrounding and besieging any towns or cities that are controlled by ISIS. And then it's like carpet bombing them. The U.S. has destroyed several cities and no one really cares. Like 80% of Ramadi is destroyed after rooting out ISIS. The point is, I mean, I don't agree with that. I don't think that's okay. But everybody in the media cheers that on. And then meanwhile, Russia's doing something similar right now in East Aleppo. And I mean, if you look at your Facebook feed, it's all you see is these images out of East Aleppo. And it's horrifying. Because you just see, like, crying children with blood everywhere, you know? And, you know, East Aleppo is an area that's held by, you know, some U.S.-backed and U.S.-allied-backed rebels that have really not-so-great ideologies. And then also Al-Qaeda, or Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria that's changed its name twice now. And so that's what's happening in Syria. So actually, when you say the U.S. and Russia should cooperate, it's like, I guess that's what they mean is they want to, you know, Russia wants the U.S. to cooperate with it in routing out Al-Qaeda. And again, I don't agree with bombing, you know, any of these bombing campaigns. But the point is that what the U.S. is doing in Syria is really nasty because they're basically, they've armed and funded for the past several years with their allies, Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Turkey, these right-wing, religiously fanatic groups. That's what's happened in Syria. And so you just have like these armed groups, and it's just bizarre because you look at the media coverage, and I mean, if you read like the New York Times or any other media outlet, you think these groups are like fighting for freedom, but they're not. And that's not to say that what the Syrian government has done is okay. I mean, Syria is a repressive police state, a very repressive police state. And no hands are clean. Everyone's hands are very, very dirty. But the U.S. is funding, like, a Contra-style insurgency in Syria. It's torn the country apart. And you just don't get that sense in the media. And when we talk about, you know, a no-fly zone, which is what Hillary Clinton has continuously said she wants to do, that no-fly zone would be on behalf of those armed opposition groups that are dominated at this point by Al-Qaeda-style groups. That if they're not called Al-Qaeda, have similar ideologies to Al-Qaeda. And even if they don't, they all work with Al-Qaeda. So that's where it's at in Syria. And a no-fly zone would basically, like, leave a vacuum for those groups to take over. Because I doubt they're going to relinquish, you know, their weapons once Assad is removed so that civil society can take over. So, yeah, in a way, the people of Syria, it sucks for them because they're stuck between this police state they didn't ever vote for and Al-Qaeda. It's almost like they're stuck between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump.
But, you know, the minute you say things like this, you're accused of being an Assadist, right?
Right.
You've heard that accusation many, many, many times. How do you plead?
I plead not guilty, but it doesn't really matter because once you're labeled an Assadist, like, it's like, of course, the first thing you're always going to say is you're not guilty. But no, it's absolutely absurd. It's a disgusting smear. And I find it so insulting, especially since I have relatives in Lebanon and Syria. And, you know, in Syria, like, I have relatives who've, you know, suffered under the, you know, Assad regimes, especially the first Assad, who was, you know, incredibly brutal. So they're no fans of the government, but they're also stuck in this spot, too, where, like, it's okay, they're minorities in the Middle East. And, you know, these groups, they really scare them. And that's how a lot of Syrians that I talk to feel, who are in the majority, it's like 70 to 80% of Syrians in Syria, like they live in government-held areas, because that's how unsavory and loathed the armed opposition groups are. People are terrified of them. They kidnap people's families and ransom them. I mean, what the U.S.-backed groups are doing is really nasty. So, yeah, to be like, to kind of impose those people on a country, I find that really arrogant. And I think it's really important for people to push back on that, especially against all these like no fly zone enthusiasts. And let's be clear here, a no fly zone means it means enforced regime change, like what we saw in Libya. I don't think a no fly zone has ever ended in anything except for a regime change.
But if a no fly zone means anything, it would mean the high risk of shooting down Russian planes, which seems like frightening.
Well, that's the other thing, too. So, like, it's, like, beyond just Syria, putting aside where, you know, like, any nuances and where you stand there. Yeah, it's, I mean, Russia is airstriking in Syria on behalf of the Syrian government and with the Syrian government. And so that would mean shooting down Russian planes, and Russia has explicitly said, you know, they're not going to take that. Like, no one would take that, especially, you know, why would you want to rile a nuclear power? And that's exactly what you would have to do in order to enforce a no-fly zone in the areas the U.S. wants to enforce them. And, I mean, Hillary Clinton said at a debate during the Democratic primary that if that means shooting down Russian planes, so be it. Like, that's insane. That is, like, utterly insane. I don't even know what to do with that.
Yeah, that seems much more frightening than any alliance that might exist between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. Which I think is largely the figment of the Democratic National Committee's imagination anyway.
It's pretty pathetic. And then that's another thing that's taking place right now, too, is like, it's like anybody who even questions that is labeled like a Putin supporter. And it's just so absurd. And it's just so crazy because it seems to work. Like, I thought, I don't know, I guess maybe I guess it must be very naive of me, because I thought, like, after things like Iraq and just like all the deceit that that has been exposed over the years because of leaks from places like WikiLeaks and you know, people would start to be a little smart about these kinds of labels. But instead, it's just like reverting back to idiocy. We're all just like Putin shills. I mean, people are like, you're being paid by Putin. And I'm like, can you even prove that? Like, I'm pretty sure I'm not, but it's so ridiculous.
As far as I know, you're not really rolling in it, right?
No, I'd love to be rolling in money, but I mean, I'm not taking it. Like, the Russians haven't even offered me any money, so...
Elsewhere in that part of the world, our good allies and Clinton Foundation contributors in Saudi Arabia are bombing the hell out of Yemen and killing lots and lots of people to very little attention.
Yeah, we're arming them and nobody gives a shit. Oh, I'm sorry, I don't know. I don't think I can say that on your program.
I'll have to bleep that out, yes.
No one cares. It's the media, the U.S. media sort of cares. Like, they, you know, they posture on it every so often. But... What Saudi Arabia is doing to Yemen, and let's be clear, it's actually not Saudi Arabia only. It's what the U.S. and Saudi Arabia are doing to Yemen is horrifying. Something like 14 million people are at risk of starvation in Yemen. That's a lot of people because of this siege that the Saudis, with U.S. help and U.K. help, have put into place. And this is the poorest country in the Middle East. Yemen is the poorest country in the Middle East, and it is being destroyed by the richest country in the Middle East with the help of the richest country in the world. And it's not just being destroyed. I mean, children, there's malnutrition intensive care units in Yemen because that's how severe the starvation crisis is. I mean, there should be no reason ever anywhere for a malnutrition intensive care unit for children. That like is beyond comprehension to me. And beyond that, you know, our alliance with Saudi Arabia, especially Hillary Clinton, and she really likes the Saudis. She's their friends. It kind of reminds me of George Bush's relationship with the Saudis. And, I mean, this is one of the most reactionary, oppressive, possibly the most oppressive and tyrannical regime in the world. And, I mean, I don't say that lightly. You know, when we talk about ISIS and the barbarities of ISIS, and ISIS is a very barbaric group that commits, like, things that, you know, some of us probably didn't think were really imaginable. Saudi Arabia is doing the same stuff. Saudi Arabia beheads people in the street. In fact, they hang people, like headless bodies on cranes, to like send a message to their population. The royal family rules with absolute fear. Women can't drive.
I'm speaking with the journalist Rania Kulik.
Did you just say headless bodies get hung up on cranes?
Yes, headless bodies. And this is not me just like, you know, making this up. I mean, it's like, it sounds like something out of like a Pamela Geller, you know, nightmare fantasy, but this is something that actually happens. And there was like there's this Frontline and BBC did an episode a few months ago where activists inside Saudi Arabia used hidden cameras to show people what the inside of Saudi Arabia is like, because you don't see this. It's you can't like take cameras in these places, and it's horrifying. Like it's absolutely horrifying the way that everyone is treated, not just women, but I mean women in particular, but everyone is treated. I mean, there's one scene where, you know, I guess music is banned in Saudi Arabia, at least in public. And, I mean, who else do we know that does that? And one of the activists takes his guitar out just to show what happens when you try and play music. And he tries to play music on his guitar on, like, a bench near his house. And within just, like, a couple minutes, the religious police show up and they break his hand. That's Saudi Arabia. It is. It's kind of just like ISIS with oil reserves. And that's, like, that's our best friend in the region who's supposedly helping us defeat ISIS, which is just absurd. I mean, this country is responsible for exporting an ideology of hatred and that, like, literally incites to murder. You know, that's why, like, 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi. But the point is that these are Hillary Clinton's best friends. It's just such a contradictory policy we have in the region. And I'm concerned because she's going to be in power and she's probably going to be our next president. And Saudi Arabia already does have so much say in shaping our policies in the Middle East. And you can imagine Obama doesn't like the Saudis and they still have all the sway that they have. So imagine what it's going to be like with, when they have an actual friend in the White House as opposed to someone who just loathes them but does as they're supposed to.
Well, that reminds me of someone else that Obama doesn't like so much, but is still quite close to, but Hillary does like very much, is Benjamin Netanyahu. What do you see in store there should Hillary become president? It seems likely.
Hillary Clinton has promised in op-eds she's written for various pro-Israel outlets that she's going to take the U.S. relationship with Netanyahu specifically to the next level. And we know from these recent leaks, the emails, that there was somebody advising Hillary Clinton's campaigns on what the Israeli government was thinking and wanting them to say and do. And the guy who was doing this, he's sending these really lengthy emails. He spoke about how much Benjamin Netanyahu hates Obama, but how much he admires Hillary Clinton, which I found interesting that he admires her. But, Hillary Clinton she's going to be a great friend to Israel, more than Obama was, if you can imagine. Obama was a really great friend to Israel, despite how awful the Israelis were to him. So, yeah, it's going to suck for Palestinians. Palestinians are going to have a rough next 4 years, really, no matter who wins. But, Hillary Clinton is really just going to step it up against them. With Hillary Clinton, I can never tell sometimes, if she's just saying what she's saying because she has to, or she feels she has to for donations. But with Israel, I think she genuinely believes what she says.
In Mark Landler's book on the Hillary-Obama relationship, he says that Obama came into office meaning to change the U.S.-Israel relationship in a significant way and was blocked at every turn by the foreign policy establishment, including Hillary. He just signed off on the biggest aid package to Israel ever. How can we take this to the next level? If this guy comes into office wanting to distance himself and finds it impossible, then he gets succeeded by an enthusiast of this relationship. What's it going to look like?
I think what it's going to look like is just more appeasement. Obama has, I hate to excuse Obama. I don't. He has been one of the best friends that Israel could possibly ask for, ever in history. That said, he has done a couple things that have pissed the Israelis off, like the Iran nuclear deal. And that's one of the reasons the Israelis dislike Obama so much, aside from thinking he's a crypto-Muslim, because a lot of them do. They also really do the Iran deal was a huge deal. That was a huge defeat for AIPAC. I don't think that's going to change much in terms of how much the U.S. supports Israel. It already does blanket support no matter what in terms of its conflict with the Palestinians. But as for what Israel wants regionally, I think that Hillary Clinton will be more willing to adjust U.S. policy to meet Israeli demands. And I'm not sure what that's going to mean for the Iran nuclear deal. I don't know that she's going to rip it up, but that's a possibility.
I said that a few times, and all these Hillary loyalists said that's not going to happen. But my feeling is that she's going to look for any excuse she can find to get out of that thing. I don't know. Am I being paranoid or conspiratorial?
No, I don't think you are. Hillary Clinton is generally hawkish anyways, and she, you have to remember too, it's the nuclear deal with Iran went through only after Hillary Clinton wasn't Secretary of State anymore. And that made a difference for not being, she was one of the obstacles to that. She was very difficult with the Iranians. We know she doesn't like the Iranians. She's called for, she said she'd be willing to obliterate them in the past. And she's continued, even as in leaked emails from State Department cables, and now the most recent batch, her paid speeches, transcripts from her paid speeches that were leaked with these emails, she has acknowledged more than once that Saudi Arabia is the number one exporter of extremist ideology in the world. Yet, still, in her public statements, she's constantly saying that it's Iran that's the biggest sponsor of terrorism in the world, which is just patently false. But that's the thing that she continues to repeat. She continues to demonize Iran. And she says she backs the nuclear deal mostly because she's just trying to echo Obama. But, Hillary Clinton is also somebody that she likes overthrowing regimes. She likes it. She's down with that. She supported Iraq, not because she was scared into it, but because she really, she was down with overthrowing the government in Iraq. She was the premier architect of what took place in Libya the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime. She even sidestepped the Pentagon to make that happen. And she's the one who, as we know, convinced Obama to go that route. And, I mean, Libya's a mess. I mean, she basically just repeated the same, I don't want to call them mistakes. I think they were kind of deliberate in Iraq, but she repeated the same behavior and conduct as the Bush administration, with like using flawed intelligence to take out a government you don't like. And then she laughed about it when Gaddafi was lynched by U.S. backed rebels. But I mean, there is reason to believe, okay, maybe Hillary Clinton's not that reckless to want to take on Iran. But at the same time, I don't think it's right to rule that out as a possibility.
Well, she's reckless enough to want to take on Russia and perhaps China as well. So, I mean, Iran's a small fry compared to those two.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Like, I went to this foreign policy fundraiser for Hillary Clinton over the summer, and it was headlined by Robert Kagan, who is, one of the leading neocons from the 90s. He was a co-founder of Project for a New American Century, PNAC, with Bill Kristol.
And whose wife worked for Hillary at the State Department.
Yeah, so his wife is Victoria Nuland, who is the Assistant Secretary of State for Eurasia, I think. And she's in Victoria Nuland, they call her the neocon in Obama's White House. And she was brought in by Hillary Clinton. And you can imagine she's going to have a high-level role in the State Department. Maybe she'll even be Secretary of State under Hillary Clinton. And Victoria Nuland is somebody who's been pressing for basically sending lethal weapons to, or I guess all weapons are lethal, but arms to Ukrainians who are fighting against Russian separatists in Ukraine. And a lot of these Ukrainians who would be arming, there are neo-Nazi groups among them, and she doesn't care. So Robert Kagan, at this foreign policy fundraiser, I talked to him, and that's something he said that Hillary Clinton was definitely going to do. She's going to arm the Ukrainians. And he basically talked about how Obama wasn't willing to confront Russia, and he promised Hillary Clinton would in both Syria and Ukraine. So I don't know if this was bluster, but, I mean, he headlined the event. So clearly the Clinton campaign feels that that his values or what he's saying is in keeping with what her campaign or what she intends to do. And so I think that people oftentimes really underestimate what Hillary Clinton is willing to do and how far she's willing to go and how reckless she's willing to be in foreign policy.
We've only got a few minutes left, but we've drifted away from the topic of Donald Trump. It's impossible, really, to divine anything coherent out of his ramblings and rantings. But do we have any sense of what a Trump foreign policy might look like?
Yeah, I really don't know, because I don't think he'd be in charge of it. I think if Trump really was elected, which I don't think is going to happen, he would just put other people in charge of everything. I don't think he really would want to govern. And because of that, I think it's hard to say. And like you said, he's totally incoherent. It's really hard to understand where he's coming from. I mean, he's been consistent on a few things. And one of those things is that he doesn't, he doesn't seem to want to go to war with Russia. And the other thing is his opposition to corporate trade deals. Otherwise, I don't know. I don't really believe much of what he says. And I don't think it's ever going to come to pass. But I do think that the fact that he's gotten this far, it marks a new pattern I think something that's going to become a pattern in elections as we go forward. And it's going to be this choice between, the status quo, Hillary Clinton type, that's still going to bring us to disaster, and just out and out either fascists or whatever you want to call Trump, authoritarians, pro-police state racists, xenophobes. And I feel like that's where we're headed. And I think that that's a pattern that's emerging around the world, too, especially in Europe and even other countries. I mentioned Syria earlier. I wasn't joking. It's this just more dramatic version where you're deciding kind of between fascists and, the sort of status quo neoliberal, whether that's a police state or a pretend democracy in America, who knows. But, yeah, it's a really disturbing feature of, the sort of modern-day politics that we're watching, and I don't like it.
Well, it's really depressing how the people are right to be afraid of Trump. He's a horrifying character, but his awfulness is being used to legitimate Hillary's version of the status quo, which is, ruled by money and American military power.
Meanwhile, nobody's even putting pressure on Hillary Clinton. Even people, I've noticed there's, people are taming or, toning down the rhetoric against her. Liberals, especially progressives, aren't being as critical of her because they're scared of Trump winning. And so it really does benefit. People like Trump existing benefit that sort of neoliberal order, because that's, they can just, A, point to Trump as, like, that's what populism looks like, and that's why it's bad, even though that's not the case. And then, B, also use it to really, like, crush or silence people who are criticizing the liberal, you know, in the race.
All right. Thanks, Rania.
Yep. Thanks, Doug. Great talking to you.
That's great. So how should I introduce you?
You can just introduce me as associate editor of the Electronic Intifada. It's fine.
Okay. Great.
Yeah.
All right,
thanks for having me on. That was fun. I
okay.
appreciate it.
All right, I'll be on Thursday. Okay, I will. Bye.
All right,
bye. I was Rania Kulik, a journalist and associate editor of the Electronic Intifada. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Everybody's Gone to War by Narina Pillow, written during the early days of the war in Iraq. And now on to Bitcoin, the digital currency that was much in the news a few years ago. But as David Golombia is about to remind us, it hasn't gone away. David Golombia is an associate professor of English at Virginia Commonwealth University and is author of The Politics of Bitcoin, Software as Right-Wing Extremism from the University of Minnesota Press. As a purely digital currency, Bitcoin has no physical existence. It exists as blocks of computer code organized around something called a blockchain, a complete ledger of transactions each unit is involved in. You trade Bitcoin and buy and sell things with it on computers or smartphones. It's mined, as they say, by specialized server farms that generate new Bitcoins using lots and lots of computing power. The technical details are too complicated to get into here, and besides, what's interesting about it is the political thinking surrounding the currency, and that's what David Golombia is here to talk about. In the interview, I mentioned Eustace Mullins without identifying him. He was a writer of fascist sympathies, not a term I use lightly, who is the author of numerous works of Holocaust denial and the like, perhaps most famous for his theorizing about the origins of the Federal Reserve as a plot of Jewish bankers like the Rothschilds. It's odious stuff that casts a long shadow, one that darkens some discourse on the left. There are plenty of things you can say critically about the Federal Reserve, but let's keep Mullins out of it. Okay, here's David Golombia. In one of his more lucid moments, Antonio Negri said that money has one face, that of the boss. It seems that Bitcoin is an attempt through money to get rid of the boss, or at least some kind, certain kind of a boss, isn't it?
Interesting. I mean, that is certainly what the rhetoric of Bitcoin says, but it does construct a very particular kind of boss, and I think it's a fiction, the boss that it constructs, right? I don't really think the central banks have quite as much control over the world as the Bitcoin people seem to think that they do.
As with most things emerging out of libertarianism, there's only one kind of boss, a statist boss, right? They're not very interested in bosses in the private sector.
Right, and in fact, you can see, I mean, Bitcoin is becoming extremely concentrated now, right? A very small number of people own most of the Bitcoins as a currency. And despite all the rhetoric of sort of distributed software, you know, as Bitcoin has progressed, it's taken more and more computing power to generate the Bitcoins. And so, of course, people with the money to run those machines have taken over. And supposedly something like 70-80% of the Bitcoin operations now are done in a few large warehouses in China whose ownership, the relation to the government and so forth is really unknown. So it's very odd to call it a distributed product, right? It is extremely concentrated at this point.
Well, it's funny. It's like it's almost a little experiment in the nature of markets, which without any kind of regulation tends towards concentration and opacity.
Absolutely. You know, they have this strange sort of faith, as a lot of libertarians do, that there's some sort of invisible hand that's keeping everything distributed, when we know for a fact that that is not how the invisible or the invisible hand tends to concentrate, if anything.
I sort of lost touch with Bitcoin. I wrote a piece for The Nation a couple of years ago about it, and I was immersed in it for a while, but then I let it fall by the wayside. It does seem to have receded in interest and volume. Am I mistaken in that perception?
Interest, I think, absolutely, although I'll talk in a second about why what's gone on with that. But volume, I'm not so sure. I think that there actually is still a lot of trading that goes on in it. And there certainly is a lot of discussion about, you know, which you will appreciate, sort of people trying to diagnose why Bitcoin is going up or down in value. And they use all kinds of literally Elliott Wave theory and all kinds of other like arcane Wall Street technical tools that are hard to apply when you understand what the underlying investment is. And with Bitcoin, there isn't really an underlying thing. So it's pretty hilarious to read the sort of market diagnoses of Bitcoin's movement as a currency after the first crash sort of Bitcoin's value, there became this whole wave of it's not Bitcoin, it's the blockchain, right? And the blockchain is the underlying technology on which Bitcoin is built. And that is really what you hear a lot more about today, in especially in venture capital. But you certainly, you know, many banks right now are experimenting with blockchain technology. You see a lot of politicians and like people in the EU. And I was just looking at a video by the Clinton Global Initiative where they have a long discussion of the blockchain.
Well, I think just the other day, Jamie Dimon was talking about taking J.P. Morgan Chase in a blockchain direction. So it's gone from being this scruffy thing for oddball libertarians in their underwear to something that the likes of Jamie Dimon is interested in.
Absolutely. And it's amazing to, you know, CoinDesk, I think, is the major Bitcoin news site about it. And it's pretty amazing to read. It's been this way for several years now where, you know, a third of the articles are Bitcoin is tearing apart the corporate and state infrastructure and the little guy is getting in there. And then a half of the articles are JP Morgan is doing Bitcoin, Chase is doing Bitcoin, you know, the U.S. government is looking into blockchain. And they kind of can't make up their mind about whether this would be success or failure. There's so much like venture capital and investor pressure about blockchain that pretty much every big institution that has anything to do with money or even sort of secure documents has to be able to say that they're working on the blockchain. You know, Microsoft, IBM, so forth, are all working on it.
That reminds me of one of the points you make in the book, which is that the proponents of Bitcoin both scorn mainstream attention and yet crave it at the same time.
And, you know, to me, that sort of contradiction, as Marx would probably even say, right, is one of the things you look for when you're looking for ideology, these things that are just incompatible with each other. And yet people seem to be able to hold them in their mind without the cognitive dissonance one would expect to be there, right? And the primary one in Bitcoin is even more fundamental, which is it an investment or a currency? The same people will crow like Bitcoin is taking over the world because it's going up in value 300% in a month, and then say, and it's so great because it's stable in value.
You do write about the classic definitions of money, which are a medium of exchange, a store of value, and a unit of account. A lot of the Bitcoin people reject the idea, the definition of money itself. Bitcoin is money, and anything that doesn't fit the definition is not right.
It's really almost hard to get your head around. Like, they get very adamant that it is money, but your definition of money is wrong.
Okay, well, let's talk about the ideology, which is the really interesting thing about this stuff. It emerges out of a cyber-libertarian world. Libertarianism is almost like the native strain ideology of a whole bunch of the tech world these days. Although the ideology itself has deep roots, you know, going back to Hayek and before. But yeah, talk about this libertarianism and how it's the soil that gave rise to Bitcoin.
The most famous sort of explicitly libertarian movements in the digital world are, there might even be one movement, the cypherpunks and the crypto anarchists, which have been around since the late 1980s. And these are people who have maybe foreseen, but also tried to make it so that technologies associated with cryptography especially would sort of redefine the entire social world. They have been talking about cryptocurrencies since the late 1980s, and they have been spouting this dogma since the late 1980s that, you know, cryptocurrency was going to rip apart the nation state. Some of the people directly involved in Bitcoin, like Nick Szabo, right, who's one of the main people behind it, he's a charter member of the cypherpunk people and been around in them for a long time, and very open, far-right person. Thought Reagan was sort of a middle-of-the-road conservative who should have gone much further. It is surprising how Bitcoin, you know, somehow emerged out of that, and yet people sort of don't want to look at the fact that, you know, you can go back and read these crypto-anarchist documents. They are talking about Bitcoin for 10 years before Bitcoin ever came into being, right? And they were very clear about what it was for. And interestingly, they to talk about the other part of the ideology, right, you see it a little bit in their writings, though not as clearly, but that sort of inward creep of the John Birch Society, Federal Reserve is run by the Rothschild Bank, you know, hard currency is, well, you do see some of the hard currency stuff, right? The idea that sort of hard currency stabilizes value in a way that floating currencies can't. But that stuff has kind of, and I guess this is what mostly interests me in the book, that it's kind of somehow gotten divorced from all of that, and you see people who really should know better talking like Alex Jones almost about money.
There are a few of the central banks that the Bitcoin proponents share. A lot of the pedigree can be traced to the likes of Eustace Mullins, right, with their conspiratorial tales of the origins of the Federal Reserve. So, you know, how does that fit into the story?
They are basically quoting Eustace Mullins, and if they aren't quoting him directly, they're quoting one of several more recent authors who basically just, you know, gesture back at him and may or may not cite him. But the language is the same. The claims are the same. You even hear people talking about, like, Jekyll Island, right, where the Federal Reserve was put together. And it's not that, I probably could say this more clearly in the book, it's not that I think, like, Federal Reserves are terrific and the Federal Reserve, and they do, you know, absolutely, they're beyond criticism. They absolutely are. Should be criticized. I just don't think that they are, you know, money-sucking vampires who give.
You know, this kind of ideology, which is also popular among some people on the left, like Ellen Brown, who is somewhat less toxic than the Eustace Mullins, you know, who are openly anti-Semitic. You know, but so there's a commonality across the political spectrum to some of these views of the central banking structure. But these people are never interested in production. They're only interested in money as the source of evil power.
Right, money and maybe consumption, and you know, even what they think money is. I mean, money is a pretty hard thing to get your head around. In any case, if you really think about it and read into it, which I've been doing a little bit for the book, right? I mean, exactly what money is it's complicated, right? And Brown is who we were, I think, just talking about a minute ago, right? I don't know exactly what her politics are, but when you read her book, like, it is mostly just like quotations out of Mullins and not always attributed to Mullins. And you do see people citing her as if she's a left figure. I don't really know how she can be. And the production side, that is, you know, they really don't want to look at the production side. That is absolutely true.
So the libertarian fantasy of Bitcoin is a money without the state, right?
Yes.
Which, of course, a lot of gold fanatics also revere about the barbarous relic. What do the gold freaks and the Bitcoin freaks have in common and not in common?
They have a lot in common. I mean, and in a lot of ways, the originating documents of Bitcoin refer to gold quite a bit as if gold has this, you know, the big thing that is in Bitcoin and, you know, to be honest, might not have to be the case in all future cryptocurrencies. But in Bitcoin, the total future supply is limited. There can only ever be 21 million bitcoins or something. And this is the feature that these people point at as being, you know, the thing that is going to stabilize its value because there's a limited amount of it, the same way there's a limited amount of gold. And there are probably some psychological reasons that people seem to think that, you know, that fact stabilizes value. As I talk about in the book a little bit, like, you can look at the historical value of gold and it's simply not true. And there's plenty of other commodities in the world of limited value that doesn't actually stabilize, you know, without a lot of other regulation imposed on top of it. The mere fact that something is limited in quantity doesn't actually make its price just be uniform over time. It's just false, right? And you can look at so many things and see that. It's a very odd claim to make, and why they actually are so attached to it, you know, I probably have some sort of dark psychological explanations for some of that, but they'd be very speculative.
Yeah, well, the psychoanalysis would be interesting because, you know, the gold and feces and the anus, I mean, that's classical psychoanalysis, but what do you do with this currency, this cryptocurrency? I don't know.
Needing it to be hard, needing it to be, you know, definite in a way that, like, instead of sort of floating, I don't know. But
disembodied, immaterial. It's like a right. It's a weird mixture of freedom and constraint all mixed up in one thing, too.
Right, yeah. It's fascinating to think about.
I ran the numbers when I wrote the Nation piece, you know, that the Bitcoin was many times more volatile than gold, which was in turn many times more volatile than the dollar. Yet their ideology, you know, it's just the reverse.
As I say in the book also, like, you can find plenty of examples of people, like even, you know, supposedly reputable Wall Street Journal journalists, you know, writing about how Bitcoin is going to stabilize currency valuations, like literally at the moment that it is fluctuating in value by tens and twenties and hundreds of.
I'm speaking with David Golombia, author of The Politics of Bitcoin, Software as Right-Wing Extremism from the University of Minnesota Press. Bitcoin is like a monetary embodiment of this cyber libertarian fantasy where computers and the internet and all like overthrow all pre-existing social relations. Yeah, talk a bit about this ideology that that Bitcoin is an embodiment of.
It is a fantasy. I think that's the right thing to say. I think it is. They don't effectively add the detail that would really explain how this works, right? They seem to have this idea that you could distribute everything among everyone and then everyone would be equal, right? There is even, I mean, that's part of why I think it is attracted to the left a little bit. There's the idea that, like, well, you distribute a little piece of this to every person and every person has the same amount and therefore we are all equal. But they seem to forget that the whole point of regulatory agencies is to try to maintain that some level of equality, and that you can't just distribute it yourself and sort of think there's that invisible hand that's keeping it in place. And so I don't think that the Bitcoin people actively want the currency or the power to become concentrated the way it has. I think that the ideology is very effective, probably for psychological reasons, and that there are some people who see that the concentration is going to happen and can profit off it, but most of them have a deluded belief in the sort of the power of maybe of machines to, you know, to sort of equalize the world that is just, it's not mapped onto anything. You know, you can ask people, well, show me an example of that happening before, and then they get very upset because you can't. That's not how things work.
At the same time, there's this vision of radical egalitarianism behind this kind of libertarianism, but also anti-egalitarianism. You know, you got people like Peter Thiel who are contemptuous of democracy and look to their version of libertarianism as ruled by an elite. There are many contradictions in the philosophy as well as the money.
There really are. Nevertheless, almost all of them, maybe with the exception of Thiel and Travis Kalanick, will use words like democratization and distribution to advertise their wares, even though they can often be pointing at very different things.
You mentioned Kalanick, who's the founder of Uber. These things seem somehow related, of this vision that the machine, the computer, is going to really transform social relations in a very utopian way, against all evidence. But
it is as if people see Uber and they don't see the company, right? They just see the app in people's hands and the cars coming around, and they seem to forget that there is this profit-seeking entity in the middle that is sort of making all of this go and also attacking democratic institutions along the way. That is not a bad version of what the fantasy is, right? That somehow, and there, of course, people have tried, maybe they'll succeed, to develop sort of Bitcoin-like, Uber-like applications that would somehow distribute the. You can see I'm getting fuzzy already because how this works is really unclear, but, you know, sort of distributed ledger-like orders for cabs that would then distribute the payment to them somehow. But, of course, those haven't really caught on because in our world, Uber delivers a certain kind of efficiency to the market that is, you know, really hard to argue, hard to defeat, right? That's how that's power.
Well, also with vast amounts of venture capital subsidies so far. I mean, these things are not self-sustaining yet.
No, not at all. That's exactly right.
But it's like there's almost a second-order commodity fetishism here where, you know, we just have the information. You know, that we have this sort of very abstract relation. It's no longer about a relation between people being a relation between commodities. It's like, you know, some sort of entries in a blockchain now.
That's very interesting. Some of the things that have changed with the digital world is that some of the ideas we have about sort of the very basic political ideas have sort of taken on a new valence. I like that idea of commodity fetishism having a, right, we were just talking about it as gold. Like they do sort of look at these ledger entries as commodities in some way. They've even, you know, there have been a few people who have tried to argue somehow that the mining operation itself is a commodity that is where Bitcoin gets its value, which I find sort of incomprehensible.
this is a non-human labor theory of value.
Right, exactly.
As with many of these cyber things, they always forget the material infrastructure. You mentioned earlier that this mining takes specialized processors and enormous amounts of energy and, you know, big server farms to get this going. You can't do it on your MacBook.
Absolutely, right. And this is another thing that where you just feel like they're holding two totally contradictory ideas in their head, because you do, in the current blockchain discussions, you see tons of reference to it as if somehow the fact that the sort of generation of these tokens is distributed is going to produce some kind of political democracy. And yet we know from the Bitcoin example that it won't be distributed for very long, right? It will eventually be concentrated in the most powerful server locations, you know, and when you look at that, that is not unlike what happened with the web itself, where you had this relatively distributed protocol where at the first people thought that, like, we were all going to run servers on our local computers and host our own web pages, and it was all going to be totally radically distributed. And what happened is it got concentrated, partially because there was no oversight to prevent that, right, or no agency or interest in preventing it. So now we, you know, a huge amount of our web surfing goes to central cloud locations, Amazon or Level 3 or whatever. If blockchain ever develops real applications, one presumes the same thing is going to happen, and that's what those big banks are all doing, right? When they say they're running blockchains or experimenting with them, they clearly are thinking that they're going to be doing a lot of the hosting and generation of that stuff on their own.
From the point of view of a user, a consumer, a holder or user of money, you want your bank to be stable. You don't want, like, every Joe and Josephina to be running his or her own server creating money. It doesn't make sense that and this ultimately backed by the state as a source of stability. This idea that people are going to entrust their, you know, their savings to something so murky and immaterial seems fantastic.
Especially when the claim is that that's somehow more stable and secure.
Now, I talked to a guy when I was writing my piece who is a enthusiastic Bitcoin fan. He's a guy on the left, not the most sophisticated fellow, but his heart was in the right place. And he urged me not to be too mean about Bitcoin because, one reason was he liked to get his drugs using Bitcoin. But what about that argument? We're moving towards a more cashless society. It's going to be harder and harder to have anonymous transactions, like for people who want to buy their drugs or whatever. What about Bitcoin as a way of just creating this realm of anonymous personal freedom?
Bitcoin really is at best pseudonymous, right? That part of the immutability of these transactions is that every single one is recorded in perpetuity. So there, you know, and there's a lot of sort of different understandings at first where people do buy drugs with Bitcoin, right? And they did. I mean, that was one of the main reasons Bitcoin became so famous at the outset was because it was at the same time as this dark web supermarket, the Silk Road, that eventually was prosecuted and shut down. And that was in the first rush of Bitcoin use. You have to do some additional things to make Bitcoin anonymous. You know, and maybe those will get incorporated or something, but currently it's strange to think it's anonymous. Now, the idea of anonymous cash transactions, I feel kind of funny about. And, you know, I think a pretty centrist economist recently just put out a book, didn't they, about eliminating cash. We'll put it this way. Anti-money laundering laws, right, kick in about $10,000 now, right? If you deposit more than $10,000 in cash, it has to be reported to the government, and under $10,000 it doesn't. And the idea is supposed to be that you're blocking major drug and human trafficking operations at some level. And I don't know that I have a problem with that. I mean, there does seem to be a kind of natural cutoff. I think in that book also, right, the idea is you would have maybe $50 bills or $20 bills, but you would no longer have $100 bills because those are the common ones that get transported and have most of their use apparently is for sort of anonymous transactions. The idea, you know, Bitcoin, some of the people really do love Bitcoin because it seems to enable $100,000 instantaneous worldwide transfers. And I have to admit, I'm people who need to do that and can't do it through a legitimate source, service, right? I have to wonder, well, what do you need to do it for? I'm not all that sympathetic with the view that, like, we need to have that as a service. I don't mind people having some oversight over major cash transactions going around the world.
All right, so finally, where do you see this going? Is it going to get co-opted and civilized by governments and big banks, or will the scruffy cyber libertarians keep trying to do their independent thing?
I think about this a lot, and my view, one of the things that's also interesting in the Bitcoin community is that they don't seem to know very much about financial technology, right? And this allows them to say Bitcoin is truly revolutionary, but they don't really know what software is being built in those banks already, right? And my view, and I think Deloitte and Touche gave a paper about this a year or so ago, blockchain in a lot of ways is a lot like a lot of the other technology that they already have going in the banks, and there is a strong likelihood that they're going to find a use for it. And they're going to adopt it, and it's going to become relatively transparent in the background, and it may be useful for some kind of intermediate steps in the whole flow of worldwide securities and currencies and so forth. I hope, and so far I think we're seeing the evidence that my hope is correct, that it is not actually going to end the nation state, and not that I wouldn't like to see revisions to the nation state, but I don't, you know, the people behind Bitcoin are not the people I want to see ending the nation state, and at this point, I don't think that's going to happen.
That was David Golombia, Associate Professor of English at Virginia Commonwealth University and author of The Politics of Bitcoin, Software as Right-Wing Extremism from the University of Minnesota Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Geld, Money, by the German post-punk band Malaria from the early 80s. Money is our faith, our religion. Till next week, bye.